Part 1. Cards in the Hand. If you must play, decide upon three things at the start: the rules of the game, the stakes, and the quitting time. Chinese proverb. Chapter 1. Little Games. 1. The game was Carousel Hazard. The stakes were roughly half of all the wealth they commanded in the entire world, and the plain truth was that Loch Lamora and Jean Tannon were getting beaten like a pair of dusty carpets.
"Last offering for the fifth hand," said the velvet-coated attendant from his podium on the other side of the circular table. "Do the gentlemen choose to receive new cards?"
"No, no. The gentlemen choose to confer," said Locke, leaning to his left to place his mouth close to Jean's ear. He lowered his voice to a whisper.
"What's your hand look like?"
"A parched desert," Jean murmured, casually moving his right hand up to cover his mouth. "How's yours?"
"A wasteland of bitter frustration."
"Shit."
"Have we been neglecting our prayers this week? Did one of us fart in a temple or something?"
"I thought the expectation of losing was all part of the plan."
"It is. I just expected we'd be able to put up a better fight than this." The attendant coughed demurely into his left hand, the card table equivalent of slapping Locke and Jean across the backs of their heads. Locke leaned away from Jean, tapped his cards lightly against the lacquered surface of the table, and grinned the best knew-what-he-was-doing sort of grin he could conjure from his facial arsenal. He sighed inwardly, glancing at the sizable pile of wooden markers that was about to make the short journey from the centre of the table to his opponent's stacks. "We are, of course, prepared," he said, "to meet our fate with heroic stoicism, worthy of mention by historians and poets." The dealer nodded.
"Ladies and gentlemen, both decline last offering. House calls for final hands?"
There was a flurry of shuffling and discarding as the four players formed their final hands and set them face down on the table before them.
"Very well," said the attendant. "Turn and reveal."
The 60 or 70 of Tal Verar's wealthiest idlers, who had crowded the room behind them to watch every turn of Locke and Jean's unfolding humiliation, now leaned forward as one, eager to see how embarrassed they would be this time. 2. Tal Verar, the Rose of the Gods, at the westernmost edge of what the Therin people call the civilized world. If you could stand in thin air 1,000 yards above Tal Verar's tallest towers, or float in lazy circles there like the nations of gulls that infest the city's crevices and rooftops, you could see how its vast dark islands have given this place its ancient nickname. They seem to whirl outward from the city's heart, a series of crescents steadily increasing in size like the stylized petals of a rose in an artist's mosaic. They are not natural, in the sense that the mainland looming a few miles to the northeast is natural. The mainland cracks before wind and weather, showing its age. The islands of Tal Verar are unweathered, possibly unweatherable. They are the black glass of the Eldrin, unimaginable quantities of it, endlessly tiered and shot through with passages glazed with layers of stone and dirt from which a city of men and women springs. This Rose of the Gods is surrounded by an artificial reef, a broken circle 3 miles in diameter, shadows under shadowed waves. Against this hidden wall, the restless sea of brass is gentled for the passage of vessels flying the banners of 100 kingdoms and dominions. Their masts and yards rise in a forest, white with furled sails, far beneath your feet. If you could turn your eye to the city's western island, you would see that its interior surfaces are sheer black walls, plunging hundreds of feet to the softly lapping harbour waves, where a network of wooden docks clings to the base of the cliffs. The seaward side of the island, however, is tiered along its entire length, Six wide, flat ledges sit one atop the other, with smooth 50-foot escarpments backing all but the highest. The southernmost district of this island is called the Golden Steps. Its six levels are thick with alehouses, dicing dens, private clubs, brothels, and fighting pits. The Golden Steps are heralded as the gambling capital of the Therin city-states, a place where men and women may lose money on anything from the mildest vices to the wickedest felonies. The authorities of Tal Verar, in a magnanimous gesture of hospitality, have decreed that no foreigner upon the Golden Steps may be impressed into slavery. As a result, there are few places west of Camor where it is safer for strangers to drink their brains out and fall asleep in the gutters and gardens. There is rigid stratification on the Golden Steps. With each successively higher tier, the quality of the establishments rises, as do the size, number, and vehemence of the guards at the doors. Crowning the Golden Steps are a dozen Baroque mansions of old stone and witchwood, embedded in the wet green luxury of manicured gardens and miniature forests. These are the chance houses of quality, exclusive clubs where men and women of funds may gamble in the style to which their letters of credit entitle them. These houses have been informal centres of power for centuries, where nobles, bureaucrats, merchants, ships' captains, legates, and spies gather to wager fortunes, both personal and political. Every possible amenity is contained within these houses. Notable visitors board carriage boxes at exclusive docks at the base of the inner harbour cliffs, and are hauled up by gleaming brass water engines, thereby avoiding the narrow, twisting, crowd-choked ramps leading up the five lower steps on their seaward face. There is even a public dueling green, a broad expanse of well-kept grass lying dead centre on the top tier, so that cooler heads need not be given any chance to prevail when someone has their blood up. The houses of quality are sacrosanct. Custom older and firmer than law forbids soldiers or constables to set foot within them, save for response to the most heinous crimes. They are the envy of a continent. No foreign club, however luxurious or exclusive, can quite recapture the particular atmosphere of a genuine Verari chance house. And they are, one and all, put to shame by the Sin Spire. Nearly 150 feet tall, the Sin Spire juts skyward at the southern end of the topmost tier of the steps, which is itself more than 250 feet above the harbour. The Sin Spire is an elderglass tower glimmering with a pearly black sheen. A wide balcony decked with alchemical lanterns circles each of its nine levels. At night, the Sin Spire is a constellation of lights in scarlet and twilight sky blue, the heraldic colours of Tal Verar. The Sin Spire is the most exclusive, most notorious, and most heavily guarded chance house in the world, open from sunset to sunrise for those powerful, wealthy, or beautiful enough to make it past the whims of the doorkeepers. Each ascending floor outdoes the one beneath it for luxury, exclusivity, and the risk-sealing of the games allowed. Access to each higher floor must be earned with good credit, amusing behaviour, and impeccable play. Some aspirants spend years of their lives and thousands of solari trying to catch the attention of the Sin Spire's master, whose ruthless hold on his unique position has made him the most powerful arbiter of social favour in the city's history. The code of conduct at the Sin Spire is unwritten, but as rigid as that of a religious cult. Most simply, most incontrovertibly, it is death to be caught cheating here. Were the Archon of Tal Verar himself to be detected with a card up his sleeve, he would find no appeal this side of the gods themselves from the consequences. Every few months, the tower's attendants discover some would-be exception to the rule, and yet another person dies quietly of an alchemical overdose in their carriage, or tragically slips from the balcony 9 stories above the hard, flat stones of the Sin Spire's courtyard. It has taken Locke Lamora and Jean Tannen 2 years and a completely new set of false identities to carefully cheat their way up to the fifth floor. They are, in fact, cheating at this very moment, trying hard to keep up with opponents who have no need to do likewise. 3. Ladies show a run of spires and a run of sabres, crowned with the sigil of the sun, said the attendant. Gentlemen show a run of chalices and a mixed hand, crowned with the five of chalices. Fifth hand is to the ladies. Locke bit the inside of his cheek as a wave of applause rippled through the warm air of the room. The ladies had taken 4 of the 5 hands so far, and the crowd had barely deigned to notice Locke and Jean's sole victory.
"Well, damn!" said Jean, incredible mock surprise.
Locke turned to the opponent on his right. Maracosa Durenna was a slender, dark-complexioned woman in her late 30s, with thick hair the colour of oil smoke and several visible scars on her neck and forearms. In her right hand she held a thin black cigar wrapped with gold thread, and on her face she wore a tight smile of detached contentment. The game was clearly not demanding her utmost exertion. The attendant flicked Locke and Jean's little pile of lost wooden counters toward the ladies' side of the table with a long-handled crop. He then used the same crop to sweep all the cards back into his hands. It was strictly forbidden for players to touch the cards after the attendant had called for the reveal.
"Well, Madame Durenna," said Locke, "my congratulations on the increasingly robust state of your finances. Your purse would seem to be the only thing growing faster than my impending hangover."
Locke knuckle-walked one of his markers over the fingers of his right hand. The little wooden disc was worth 5 solari, roughly 8 months' pay for a common labourer.
"My condolences on a particularly unfortunate run of cards, Master Costa."
Madame Durenna took a long drag from her cigar, then slowly exhaled a stream of smoke so that it hung in the air between Locke and Jean, just far enough away to avoid direct insult. Locke had come to recognize that she used the cigar smoke as her strapetit, her little game, an ostensibly civilized mannerism actually cultivated to distract or annoy opponents at a gaming table and goad them into mistakes. Jean had planned to use his own cigars for the same purpose, but Durenna's aim was better.
"No run of cards could be considered truly unfortunate in the presence of such a lovely pair of opponents," said Locke.
"I could almost admire a man who can stay so charmingly dishonest while being bled of all his silver," said Durenna's partner, who was seated on Durenna's right, between her and the dealer. Ismila Corvalour was nearly of a size with Jean, wide and florid, prodigiously rounded in every place a woman could be round. She was undeniably attractive, but the intelligence that shone out of her eyes was sharp and contemptuous. In her, Locke recognized a contained pugnacity akin to that of a street brawler, a honed appetite for hard contests. Corvalour nibbled constantly from a silver-gilded box of cherries coated in powdered chocolate, sucking her fingers loudly after each one. Her own strapetit, of course. She was purpose-built for carousel hazard, thought Locke. A mind for the cards and a frame capable of withstanding the game's unique punishment for losing a hand. "Default," said the attendant.
Within his podium he tripped the mechanism that set the carousel spinning. This device, in the center of the table, was a set of circular brass frames that held row upon row of tiny glass vials, each one capped in silver. It whirled under the soft lantern light of the gaming parlor until it became continuous streaks of silver within brass, and then a clinking sound of mechanisms beneath the table, the rattle of many tiny vessels of thick glass colliding with one another, and the carousel spat out 2 of its vials. They rolled toward Locke and Jean and clattered against the slightly upraised outer rim of the table. Carousel Hazard was a game for 2 teams of 2,
an expensive game, for the clockwork carousel mechanism came very dear. At the end of each hand, the losing team was randomly dispensed 2 vials from the carousel's great store of little bottles. These held liquor, mixed with sweet oils and fruit juice to disguise the potency of any given drink. The cards were only one aspect of the game. Players also had to maintain concentration under the increasing effects of the devilish little vials. The only way a game could end was for a player to become too drunk to keep playing. Theoretically, the game could not be cheated. The Sinspire maintained the mechanism and prepared the vials. The little silver caps were fastened tight over wax seals. Players were not permitted to touch the carousel or another player's vials on pain of immediate default. Even the chocolates and cigars being consumed by the players had to be provided by the house. Locke and Jean could even have refused to allow Madame Corvalure the luxury of her sweets, but that would have been a bad idea for several reasons.
"Well," said Jean, as he cracked the seal on his tiny libation, "here's to charming losers, I suppose."
"If only we knew where to find some," said Locke, and in unison they tossed back their drinks. Locke's left a warm, plum-flavored trail down his throat. It was one of the potent ones. He sighed and set the empty vial down before him. 4 vials to 1, and the way his concentration seemed to be unraveling at the edges meant that he was beginning to feel it. As the attendants sorted and shuffled the cards for the next hand, Madame de Rennes took another long, satisfied draw on her cigar and flicked the ashes into a solid gold pot set on a pedestal behind her right hand. She exhaled 2 lazy streams of smoke through her nose and stared at the carousel from behind a grey veil. Durenna was a natural ambush predator, Locke thought, always most comfortable behind some camouflage. His information said that she was only recently arrived in the life of a city-bound merchant speculator. Her previous profession had been the command of bounty privateers, hunting and sinking the slaver ships of Jerem on the high seas. She hadn't acquired those scars drinking tea in anyone's parlour. It would be very, very unfortunate if a woman like her were to realise that Locke and Jean were counting on what Locke liked to call discreetly unorthodox methods to win the game. Hell, it would be preferable to simply lose the old-fashioned way, or to be caught cheating by the Sinspire attendants. They, at least, would probably be quick and efficient executioners. They had a very busy establishment to run.
"Hold the cards," said Madame Corvalure to the attendant, interrupting Locke's musings. "Mara, the gentlemen have indeed had several hands of unfortunate luck. Might we not allow them a recess?"
Locke concealed his instant excitement. The pair of carousel hazard partners that held the lead could offer their opponents a short break from the game, but the courtesy was rarely extended, for the obvious reason that it allowed the losers precious time to shake the effects of their liquor. Was Corvalure trying to cover for some distress of her own?
"The gentlemen have seen a great deal of strenuous effort on our behalf, counting all those markers and pushing them over to us again and again."
Durenna drew smoke, expelled it.
"You would honour us, gentlemen, if you would consent to a short pause to refresh and recover yourselves."
"Ah." Locke smiled and folded his hands on the table before him. So that was the game. Play to the crowd and show off how little regard the ladies truly had for their opponents, how inevitable they considered their own victory. This was etiquette fencing, and Durenna had performed the equivalent of a lunge for the throat. Outright refusal would be terrible form. Locke and Jean's parry would have to be delicate.
"How could anything be more refreshing," said Jean, "than to continue our game against such an excellent partnership?"
"You're too kind, Master de Ferrer," said Madame de Rennes. "But would you have it said that we were heartless? You've refused us neither of our comforts." She used her cigar to gesture at Madame Corvalure's sweets.
Would you refuse us our desire to give a comfort in exchange?
We would refuse you nothing, madam. And yet we would beg leave to answer your greater desire, for which you've troubled yourselves to come here tonight, the desire to play.
There are many hands yet before us, added Locke, and it would wound Jerome and myself to inconvenience the ladies in any way.
He made eye contact with the dealer as he spoke.
You have thus far presented no inconvenience, said Madame Corvalier sweetly.
Locke was uncomfortably aware that the attention of the crowd was indeed hanging on this exchange. He and Jean had challenged the two women widely regarded as the best carousel hazard players in Tal Verar, and a substantial audience had packed all the other tables on the fifth floor of the Sinspire. Those tables should have been hosting games of their own, but by some unspoken understanding between the house and its patrons, other action in the parlour had ceased for the duration of the slaughter.
Very well, said Durenna. We've no objection to continuing, for our sakes. Perhaps your luck may even turn.
Locke's relief that she had abandoned her conversational ploy was faint. She did, after all, have every expectation of continuing to thrash money out of him and Jean, like a cook might beat weevils from a bag of flour.
Sixth hand, said the attendant. Initial wager will be 10 solari.
As each player pushed forward 2 wooden coins, the attendant tossed 3 cards down in front of them. Madame Corvalier finished another chocolate-dusted cherry and sucked the sweet residue from her fingers. Before touching his cards, Jean slid the fingers of his left hand briefly under the lapel of his coat and moved them as though scratching an itch. After a few seconds, Locke did the same. Locke caught Madame de Rena watching them and saw her roll her eyes. Signals between players were perfectly acceptable, but a bit more subtlety was preferred. Durenna, Locke, and Jean peeked at their cards almost simultaneously. Corvalier was a moment behind them, with her fingers still wet. She laughed quietly. Genuine good fortune or stra petit? Durenna looked eminently satisfied, but Locke had no doubt she maintained that precise expression even in her sleep. Jean's face revealed nothing, and Locke, for his part, tried on a thin smirk, although his 3 opening cards were pure trash. Across the room, a curving set of brass-railed stairs, with a large attendant guarding their foot, led up toward the 6th floor, briefly expanding into a sort of gallery on the way. A flicker of movement from this gallery caught Locke's attention. Half-concealed in shadow was a slight, well-dressed figure. The warm golden light of the room's lanterns was reflected in a pair of optics, and Locke felt a shivery thrill of excitement along his spine. Could it be? Locke tried to keep one eye on the shadowy figure while pretending to fixate on his cards. The glare on those optics didn't waver or shift. The man was staring at their table, all right. At last he and Jean had attracted, or stumbled into, and by the gods they'd take that bit of luck, the attention of the man who kept his offices on the 9th floor, master of the Sinspire, clandestine ruler of all Tal Verar's thieves, a man with an iron grip on the worlds of larceny and luxury both. In Camor they would have called him Kappa, but here he affected no title save his own name. Requin. Locke cleared his throat, turned his eyes back to the table, and prepared to lose another hand with grace. Out on the dark water, the soft echo of ship's bells could be heard, ringing the 10th hour of the evening. 4.
18th hand, said the dealer. Initial wager will be 10 solari.
Locke had to push aside the 11 little vials before him with a visibly shaking hand to slide his buy-in forward. Madame Durenna, steady as a dry-docked ship, was working on her 4th cigar of the night. Madame Corvalier seemed to be wavering in her seat. Was she perhaps more red-cheeked than usual? Locke tried not to stare too intently as she placed her initial wager,
Perhaps the waver came solely from his own impending inebriation. It was nearing midnight, and the smoke-laced air of the stuffy room scratched at Locke's eyes and throat like wool. The dealer, emotionless and alert as ever, he seemed to have more clockwork in him than the carousel did, flicked three cards to the tabletop before Locke. Locke ran his fingers under his coat lapel, then peeked at his cards and said, "Aha," with a tone of interested pleasure. They were an astonishing constellation of crap. His worst hand yet. Locke blinked and squinted, wondering if the alcohol was somehow masking a set of decent cards, but alas, when he concentrated again, they were still worthless. The ladies had been forced to drink last, but unless Jean concealed a major miracle on the tabletop to Locke's left, it was a good bet that another little vial would soon be rolling merrily across the table toward Locke's wobbling hand. 18 hands, thought Locke, to lose 980 solari thus far. His mind, well wet by the Sinspire's liquor, wandered off on its own calculations. A year of fine new clothes for a man of high station, a small ship, a very large house, the complete lifetime earnings of an honest artisan like a stonemason. Had he ever pretended to be a stonemason? "First options," said the dealer, snapping him back to the game. "Card," said Jean. The attendant slid one to him. Jean peeked at it, nodded, and slid another wooden chit toward the center of the table. "Bid up." "Hold fast," said Madame Durenna. She moved two wooden chits forward from her substantial pile. "Partner reveal." She showed two cards from her hand to Madame Corvalure, who was unable to contain a smile. "Card," said Locke. The attendant passed him one, and he turned up an edge just far enough to see what it was. The two of chalices, worth precisely one wet shit from a sick dog in this situation. He forced himself to smile. "Bid up," he said, sliding two markers forward. "I'm feeling blessed." All eyes turned expectantly to Madame Corvalure, who plucked a chocolate-dusted cherry from her dwindling supply, popped it into her mouth, and then rapidly sucked her fingers clean.
"Oh-ho," she said, staring down at her cards and drumming one set of sticky fingers gently on the table. "Oh-ho! Oh, Mara, this is the oddest."
And then she slumped forward, settling her head onto her large pile of wooden markers on the tabletop. Her cards fluttered down face up, and she slapped at them without coordination, trying to cover them up.
"Is Miller?" said Madame Durenna, a note of urgency in her voice. "Is Miller?"
She reached over and shook her partner by her heavy shoulders.
"Zwila,"
Madame Corvalure agreed in a sleepy, blubbering voice. Her mouth lolled open and she drooled remnants of chocolate and cherry onto her five solari chits.
"Mila, very odd, oddest. Play sits with Madame Corvalure."
The dealer couldn't keep his surprise out of his voice.
"Madame Corvalure must state a preference."
"Ismila, concentrate!"
Madame Durenna spoke in an urgent whisper.
"There are cards," mumbled Corvalure. "Look out, Mara, so many cards on table."
She followed that up with,
"Blemble la flaga."
And then she was out cold.
"Final default,"
said the dealer after a few seconds. With his crop, he swept all of Madame Durenna's markers away from her, counting rapidly. Locke and Jean would take everything on the table. The looming threat of 1,000 solari loss had just become a gain of equal magnitude, and Locke sighed with relief. The dealer considered the spectacle of Madame Corvalure using her wooden markers as a pillow, and he coughed into his hand.
Gentlemen, he said, the house will, provide new chits of the appropriate value in place of those still in use.
Of course, said Jean, gently patting the little mountain of Durenna's markers suddenly piled up before him. In the crowd behind them, Locke could hear noises of bewilderment, consternation, and surprise. A light ripple of applause was eventually coaxed into existence by some of the more generous observers, but it died quickly. They were faintly embarrassed, rather than exhilarated, to see a notable like Madame Corvalier inebriated by a mere 6 drinks. Said Madame Durenna, stubbing out her cigar in the gold pot and rising to her feet. She made a show of straightening her jacket. Black brocaded velvet decorated with platinum buttons and cloth of silver, worth a good fraction of everything she'd bet that night.
Master Costa, Master de Ferra, it appears we must admit to being outmatched.
But certainly not outplayed, said Locke, summoning up a snake-charming smile along with the pulverized remnants of his wits. You very nearly had us, sewn up.
And the whole world is wobbling around me, said Jean, whose hands were as steady as a jeweler's and had been throughout the entire game.
Gentlemen, I have appreciated your stimulating company, said Madame Durenna in a tone of voice that indicated she hadn't. Another game later this week, perhaps? Surely you must allow us a chance at revenge, for honour's sake.
Nothing would please us more, said Jean, to which Locke nodded enthusiastically, making the contents of his skull ache. At that, Madame Durenna coldly held out her hand and consented for the two of them to kiss the air above it. When they had done so, as though making obeisance to a particularly irritable snake, 4 of Requin's attendants appeared to help move the snoring Madame Corvalier somewhere more decorous.
Gods, it must be tedious watching us try to drink one another under the table night after night, said Jean.
He flipped the dealer a 5 solari chit. It was customary to leave a small gratuity for the attendant.
I don't believe so, sir. How would you like your change?
What change? Jean smiled. Keep the whole thing. The attendant betrayed human emotions for the 2nd time that night. Relatively well off as he was, 1 little wooden chit was half his annual salary. He stifled a gasp when Locke threw him another 12.
Fortune is a lady who likes to be passed around, said Locke. Buy a house, maybe. I'm having a little trouble counting at the moment.
Sweet gods! Many thanks, gentlemen!
The attendant took a quick glance around, and then spoke under his breath.
Those 2 ladies don't lose very often, you know. In fact, this is the 1st time I can remember.
Victory has its price, said Locke. I suspect my head will be paying it when I wake up tomorrow.
Madame Corvalier was hauled carefully down the stairs, with Madame Durenna following to keep a close eye on the men carrying her card partner. The crowd dispersed. Those observers who remained at their tables called for attendance, food, new decks of cards for games of their own. Locke and Jean gathered their markers. Fresh ones, sans slobber, were swiftly provided by the attendants to replace Madame Corvalier's, in the customary velvet-lined wooden boxes, and made their way to the stairs.
"Congratulations, gentlemen," said the attendant guarding the way up to the 6th floor.
The tinkle of glass on glass and the murmur of conversation could be heard filtering down from above.
"Thank you," said Locke. "I'm afraid that something in Madame Corvalier gave way just a hand or two before I might have done the same."
He and Jean slowly made their way down the stairs that curved all the way around the inside of the Sinspire's exterior wall. They were dressed as men of credit and consequence in the current height of Ferrari summer fashion. Locke, whose hair had been alchemically shifted to a sunny shade of blonde, wore a caramel-brown coat with a cinched waist and flaring knee-length tails.
His huge triple-layered cuffs were panelled in orange and black and decorated with gold buttons. He wore no waistcoat, just a sweat-soaked tunic of the finest silk under a loose black neckcloth. Jean was dressed similarly, though his coat was the greyish blue of a sea under clouds, and his belly was cinched up with a wide black sash, the same colour as the short curly hairs of his beard. Down past floors of notables they went, past queens of Ferrari commerce with their decorative young companions of both sexes on their arms like pets, past men and women with purchased Lashani titles, staring across cards and wine decanters at lesser dons and donyas from Camorre, past Vadran shipmasters in tight black coats, with sea tans like masks over their sharp, pale features. Locke recognized at least two members of the Priori, the merchant council that theoretically ruled Tal Verar. Deep pockets seemed to be the primary qualification for membership. Dice fell and glasses clinked. Celebrants laughed and coughed and cursed and sighed. Currents of smoke moved languidly in the warm air, carrying scents of perfume and wine, sweat and roast meats, and here and there the resiny hint of alchemical drugs. Locke had seen genuine palaces and mansions before. The Sinspire, opulent as it was not so very much more handsome than the homes many of these people would be returning to when they finally ran out of night to play in. The real magic of the Sinspire was woven from its capricious exclusivity. Deny something to enough people, and sooner or later it will grow a mystique as thick as fog. Nearly hidden at the rear of the first floor was a heavy wooden booth manned by several unusually large attendants. Luckily, there was no line. Locke set his box down on the countertop beneath the booth's only window, a bit too forcefully. All to my account.
My pleasure, Master Costa, said the chief attendant as he took the box.
Leocanto Costa, merchant speculator of Talisham, was well known in this kingdom of wine fumes and wagers. The attendant swiftly changed Locke's pile of wooden chits into a few marks on a ledger. In beating Durenna and Corvalur, even minus his tip to the dealer, Locke's cut of the winnings came to nearly 500 solari.
I understand that congratulations are in order to the both of you, Master de Ferra, said the attendant as Locke stepped back to let Jean approach the counter with his own box.
Jerome de Ferra, also of Talisham, was Leocanto's boon companion. They were a pair of fictional peas in a pod. Suddenly, Locke felt a hand fall onto his left shoulder. He turned warily and found himself facing a woman with curly dark hair, richly dressed in the same colours as the Sinspire attendants. One side of her face was sublimely beautiful. The other side was a leathery brown half-mask, wrinkled, as though it had been badly burned. When she smiled, the damaged side of her lips failed to move. It seemed to Locke as though a living woman was somehow struggling to emerge from within a rough clay sculpture.
Selendri, Requin's majordomo.
The hand that she had placed on his shoulder, her left on the burned side, wasn't real. It was a solid brass simulacrum, and it gleamed dully in the lantern light as she withdrew it.
The house congratulates you,
she said in her eerie, lisping voice,
for good manners as well as considerable fortitude, and wishes you and Master de Ferra to know that you would both be welcome on the sixth floor, should you choose to exercise the privilege.
Locke's smile was quite genuine.
Many thanks, on behalf of myself and my partner, he said with tipsy glibness. The kind regard of the house is, of course, extremely flattering.
She nodded noncommittally, then slipped away into the crowd as quickly as she'd come. Eyebrows went up appreciatively here and there. Few of Requin's guests, to Locke's knowledge, were apprised of their increasing social status by Selendri herself.
We're a commodity in demand, my dear Jerome, he said, as they made their way through the crowd toward the front doors.
For the time being, said Jean.
Master de Ferra, beamed the head doorman as they approached. "And Master Costa, may I call for a carriage?"
"No need, thanks," said Locke. "I'll fall over sideways if I don't flush my head with some night air. We'll walk."
"Very good then, sir."
With military precision, four attendants held the doors open for Locke and Jean to pass. The two thieves stepped carefully down a wide set of stone steps covered with a red velvet carpet. That carpet was thrown out and replaced each night. As a result, in Tal Varah alone could one find armies of beggars routinely sleeping on piles of red velvet scraps. The view was breathtaking. To their right, the whole crescent sweep of the island was visible beyond the silhouettes of other chance houses. There was relative darkness in the north, in contrast to the aura-like glow of the golden steppes. Beyond the city, to the south, west, and north, the sea of brass gleamed phosphorescent silver, lit by three moons in a cloudless sky. Here and there the sails of distant ships reached up from the quicksilver tableau, ghostly pale. Locke could gaze downward to his left and see across the staggered rooftops of the island's five lower tiers, a vertigo-inducing view despite the solidity of the stones beneath his feet. All around him was the murmur of human pleasure and the clatter of horse-drawn carriages on cobbles. There were at least a dozen moving or waiting along the straight avenue atop the sixth tier. Above, the sin spire reared up into the opalescent darkness with its alchemical lanterns bright, like a candle meant to draw the attentions of the gods.
"And now, my dear professional pessimist," said Locke as they stepped away from the sin spire and acquired relative privacy, "my worry merchant, my tireless font of doubt and derision, what do you have to say to that?"
"Oh, very little, to be sure, Master Costa. It's so hard to think, overawed as I am with the sublime genius of your plan."
"That bears some vague resemblance to sarcasm."
"Gods forfend," said Jean. "You wound me. Your inexpressible criminal virtues have triumphed again, as inevitably as the tides come and go. I cast myself at your feet and beg for absolution. Yours is the genius that nourishes the heart of the world.
And now you're..."
"If only there was a leper handy," interrupted Jean, "so you could lay your hands on and magically heal him."
"Oh, you're just farting out your mouth because you're jealous."
"It's possible," said Jean. "Actually, we are substantially enriched. Not caught, not dead, more famous, and welcome on the next floor up. I must admit that I was wrong to call it a silly scheme."
"Really? Huh."
Locke reached under his coat lapels as he spoke.
"Because I have to admit, it was a silly scheme. Damned irresponsible. One drink more and I would have been finished. I'm actually pretty bloody surprised we pulled it off."
He fumbled beneath his coat for a second or two, then pulled out a little pad of wool about as wide and long as his thumb. A puff of dust was shaken from the wool when Locke slipped it into one of his outer pockets, and he wiped his hands vigorously on his sleeves as they walked along.
"Nearly lost is just another way to say finally won," said Jean.
"Nonetheless, the liquor almost did me in. Next time I'm that optimistic about my own capacity, correct me with a hatchet to the skull."
"I'd be glad to correct you with two."
It was Madame Ismila Corvalur who had made the scheme possible. Madame Corvalur, who'd first crossed paths with Leocanto Costa at a gaming table a few weeks earlier, who had the reliable habit of eating with her fingers to annoy her opponents while she played cards. Carousel Hazard really couldn't be cheated by any traditional means. None of Requin's attendants would stack a deck, not once in 100 years, not even in exchange for a dukedom. Nor could any player alter the carousel, select one vial in favour of another, or serve a vial to anyone else. With all the usual means of introducing a foreign substance to another player guarded against, the only remaining possibility was for a player to do herself in by slowly, willingly taking in something subtle and unorthodox. something delivered by a means beyond the ken of even a healthy paranoia. Like a narcotic powder, dusted on the playing cards in minute quantities by Locke and Jean, then gradually passed around the table to a woman continually licking her fingers as she played. Bella Paranella was a colourless, tasteless alchemical powder, also known as the Night Friend. It was popular with rich people of a nervous disposition, who took it to ease themselves into deep, restful slumber. When mixed with alcohol, Bella Paranella was rapidly effective in tiny quantities. The two substances were as complementary as fire and dry parchment. It would have been widely used for criminal purposes if not for the fact that it sold for 20 times its own weight in white iron.
"Gods, that woman had the constitution of a war galley," said Locke. "She must have started getting some of the powder by the third or fourth hand. Probably could have killed a pair of wild boars in heat with less."
"At least we got what we wanted," said Jean, removing his own powder reservoir from his coat. He considered it for a moment, shrugged, and slipped it in a pocket.
"We did indeed. And I saw him," said Locke. "Requin. He was on the stairs, watching us for most of the hands in the middle game. We must have excited a personal interest."
The exciting ramifications of this helped clear some of the haze from Locke's thoughts. Why else send Selendri herself to pat our backs?
"Well, assume you're correct. So what now? Do you want to push on with it, like you mentioned, or do you want to take it slow? Maybe gamble around on the fifth and sixth floors for a few more weeks?"
"A few more weeks? To hell with that. We've been kicking around this goddamned city for 2 years now. If we finally cracked Requin's shell, I say we bloody well go for it."
"You're going to suggest tomorrow night, aren't you?"
"His curiosity's piqued. Let's strike while the blade is fresh from the forge."
"I suspect that drink has made you impulsive."
"Drink makes me see funny. The gods make me impulsive."
"You there," came a voice from the street in front of them. "Hold it."
Locke tensed.
"I beg your pardon?"
A young, harried-looking Ferrari man with long black hair was holding his hands out, palms facing toward Locke and Jean. A small, well-dressed crowd seemed to have gathered beside him, at the edge of a trim lawn that Locke recognized as the dueling green.
"Hold it, sirs, I beg of you," said the young man. "I'm afraid it's an affair, and there may be a bolt flying past. Might I beg of you to wait but a moment?"
"Oh!"
Locke and Jean relaxed simultaneously. If someone was dueling with crossbows, it was common courtesy as well as good sense to wait beside the dueling ground until the shots were taken. That way neither participant would be distracted by movement in the background or accidentally bury a bolt in a passer-by. The dueling green was about 40 yards long and half as wide, lit at each of its four corners by a soft white lantern hanging in a black iron frame. Two duelists stood in the centre of the green with their seconds, each man casting four pale grey shadows in a criss-cross pattern. Locke had little personal inclination to watch, but he reminded himself that he was supposed to be Leocanto Costa, a man of worldly indifference to strangers punching holes in one another. He and Jean squeezed into the crowd of spectators as unobtrusively as possible. A similar crowd had formed on the other side of the green.